Well, here we are again. Mr. Speaker, President Huggins, all of my friends, fellow legislators and Alaskans, thank you for the opportunity to be back yet again. It's been 12 years. Just saw Andrew Halcrow in the bleacher seats back there, and it's just hard to believe that I've been representing you back in Washington, D.C. now for 12 years, and that it's been that long since I have been with you as a member in the House calling you colleagues. So thank you for the welcome home this morning. You come in on a day like today with the blue skies and the fresh snow, and you just think it doesn't get any better than this. We are just so blessed and so fortunate to call this place home. So it's so good. It dawned on me as I was preparing for this speech and the multiple drafts that I go through, it dawns on me that there is a real tendency in these legislative speeches where things just sound like what we said last year. Like there's kind of more of the same. It's kind of like the figure skating competition in Sochi right now. There's a number of mandatory elements that go to a legislative speech. So I want to run quickly through some of these and then get to the fun part, the interactive dialogue that we have through the Q&As. But you know, I don't start any speech with you before I talk about my family, because my family is what puts the smile on my face and allows me to just settle back and be who I am. Vern and the dog are coming back to Alaska the first part of March. He's going to be focusing on his pasta company again. So those of you that live in Anchorage or those of you that are visiting, fresh pasta is good. So. But we'll be spending some good time in Anchorage. The boys are doing well. Our youngest just turned 21. He is a junior in college, but what he really does is extreme ski competition. His older brother graduated with a degree in finance in May, and he just finished his first and hopefully last season on the Bering Sea as a Bering Sea crab fisherman. They had a very successful season, and the best news that happened to me yesterday was I got a call from him. He's back in cell service. They are on their way home, and I can kind of take a deep breath now. I have suggested to my colleagues in Washington, D.C. that between a son that's an extreme skier and one that's a Bering Sea crab fisherman, can go to hell in a handbasket here in Washington, but it's going to be calm compared to what my personal life has been like. So maybe that is what helps balance me. But I will tell you, I recognize that as dangerous as our fishing is, certainly in the Bering Sea on the crab grounds, it is not near what it was before Ted Stevens and others really led the effort to reform our fisheries, to really eliminate that race for the crab resource, and really help to eliminate some of the dangers. So I've been thinking about Ted Stevens, and I, quite honestly, I say thank you for looking out for my boy and the men and women that are on our seas. So. I want to start off by noting an absence. As I mentioned, 12 years here, but my friend Beth Kurtula has always been somewhere right around here. And for those of you who will be seeing her or talking to her, please tell her that I miss her. I thank her for her contributions to our state. She's a good lady and a good friend, and I think she's missed in our process here. So, to Beth. And I know a few of you have had a few health setbacks, and I hope that you're doing better. Charisse, it's good to see you. Johnny, hope you're doing better. Fred, all family here, and know that we think about you. Okay, so let's start kind of the figure skating routine here. First on the menu, you got to start off talking about what we deal with in our state, and that's the issue of federal overreach and the challenges that it presents to our ability to develop and maintain a thriving economy. You know, we sought statehood because Washington was frustrating our hopes and our dreams. And this week, a lot of us are reflecting on the life and times of our territorial governor, Mike Stepovich, good family friend of ours. And we're reminded that Washington just doesn't give up control very easily. And Mike said so himself about two decades into statehood. He said, the fundamentals don't change. And by that, he meant that Alaska's rich potential will always be the reason that we're engaged in this struggle over its control. Now, I would argue that we have more federal restrictions on us now than ever before. Implementation of the roadless rule in the Tongass is just the latest chapter of decades of federal insult to Southeast's economy, not only choking out the last of the timber industry, but also limiting our ability to build out our renewable energy resources. I mean, it is really tough. It's not impossible, but it is really tough to build or maintain a transmission system if you don't have access by road. Now, we won the fight to build a bridge out there on CD5 in the National Petroleum Reserve, but now we're being told that you can't have the road. The Eisenbeck fight is all about a short connector road. So, you notice a theme going on here? It seems to me that we can't build any roads. How do you operate? How do you move if you can't access? And of course, we feel the restriction off of our shores, too. The Interior Department sold leases in Alaska's Arctic waters, but since then, they really haven't shown that they actually want development to occur. That was 6 years ago. Shell has spent billions of dollars, and we have yet to see an exploration well to be fully drilled. Now, we're counting on this same Department of Interior to fix the EIS and effectively restore confidence that drilling can move forward in the Arctic. Now, we've got a new lease sale that is scheduled to be offered for the Alaska Arctic coming up in 2016. But really, you've got to ask the question here. Who is going to bid on that under the status quo? Who's actually going to step up to that? With Pebble, the EPA is teed up to preemptively prohibit development of state lands, too. They're not even waiting, for the permit applications to be filed. And you can be, it doesn't make any difference whether you are opposed to Pebble or whether you support the project. The decision belongs to Alaska, not to EPA, and it sets a dangerous precedent for future development, not only here, but around the country. Faced with all this pressure, the state must be aggressive in developing the lands where it still has a modicum of control. Thank you. I am encouraged by this legislature's willingness to offer oil and gas producers a tax regime that promotes investment. We're already seeing results that are being demonstrated within our economy. And I know that this was a tough vote, but I admire your courage. This legislature has taken some serious steps to try and boost TAP's throughput. And I think it's long past time that the federal government step up and do the same. But we know that overreach isn't necessarily limited to developing our natural resources. Take, for instance, the Affordable Care Act. We now know if you like your insurance, you can't necessarily keep it. Or you can, but it's probably going to cost you more. The website launch was a failure. Affordable plans are not affordable. And while more than 5,000 Alaskans have signed up for the exchange, that's just about the same number as received letters late last year saying that they had lost their health care. So we're seeing one problem rise up after another. It's kind of like the proverbial whack-a-mole game. And that explains why the administration keeps pushing off the effective date of the employer mandate. We saw that just again last week. Other areas, Second Amendment. A lot of Alaskans were rightfully concerned about further restrictions on guns and gun owners following the Sandy Hook and the Aurora tragedies last year. And I have spent long, long, sad hours with families who have suffered. But placing new burdens on law-abiding gun owners is not the answer here. And I'm immovable on this, and we saw last year in the Senate that they were as well. There is common ground, however, on mental health issues. I'm certainly intending to devote my energies to a preventive approach to stopping these tragic and senseless shootings. These are big issues. But there are also little indignities that we see as well. And they're little, perhaps from a news perspective, but to those to whom they impact, they are big. They are of consequence. The veterinary clinic down in Soldotna that was told by the EPA that it was going to have to spend $50,000 a year on emissions tests for its small cremation incinerator. Driving your veterinarian husband and wife couple out of business. The daycare provider who took a handful of preschoolers on a picnic field trip down in Wrangell, cited with a $350 fine by the Forest Service because she didn't have a permit to operate her business in the Tongass. You know, it took an act of Congress, almost, certainly the intervention of a senator, to make sure that that citation was waived. Fortunately, the chief of the Forest Service happened to be in the state at the time that that came out in the Wrangell Sentinel. But again, where's the common sense here? Where's the ability to work with the people who live in the Tongass? Overreach seems to be written into Washington's DNA, but we've got to work aggressively through it and around it. So what do you do then when you're faced with, effectively, a dysfunctional Congress? We've all heard the adjectives and the description. It's cold, it's dark, it's testy, lowest public confidence in history. It's all true. Unfortunate, it's all true. And the top-down institutional rules changes that are being imposed, unfortunately, are making it worse. The president has said this is a year of action, but when you look through his State of the Union speech, what really comes out clear is this mantra that 2014 is, I'm tired of working with Congress, I'm going to go it alone. And unfortunately, not to be outdone, we're seeing that in the Senate. Harry Reid has made that strategy his own. He's decided that it's difficult to deal with a Senate minority. It's difficult to deal with a minority. So his majority is largely ignoring the committee process, even when we're producing some good bipartisan results. They've all but taken away our ability to offer amendments on the floor. We've got less ability to modify bills and virtually no opportunity to object to controversial nominees. Now, what we're dealing with now with these rule changes impact the nominations process, but it may only be a matter of time before this Senate majority ends the right to filibuster legislation. So think about what that potentially means for us as a state here. If we're trying to keep Anwar from being designated as permanent wilderness, all of this really undermines the fundamental constitutional principles. The founding fathers structured the Senate to protect the rights of states with small populations like Alaska, giving them that equal representation and protecting those minority rights. So unlike the House, there in the Senate, here in the Senate, we've got, I as a senator from Alaska have that same weight and ability to advance and to speak with a voice as a senator from New York or California. So what we're seeing in the Senate, these changes are not good for Alaska. They're not good for the Senate. I don't think that they're good for the country. I was asked, it was just this weekend, I was up in Anchorage, and I was asked by a constituent, they said, man, it's so crazy back in Washington, D.C. He says, how can you possibly deal with all of the nonsense, all of the frustration of D.C., and just keep calm at all? And the answer really is, I know who I work for. And it's every legislator in this room and our constituents in every single corner of this state. And it keeps you grounded when you know who it is that you serve. My focus remains on getting things done for our state. And sometimes that means wearing a lot of different hats. You're an advocate, you're a mediator, you're an ambassador, and quite frankly, you're an educator. At times, the educator role is most important. And when you think about it, you know, why education? Well, we know that folks on the outside, actually folks from the inside, we can all turn into these reality TV shows. We've got a dozen of them each week. Everybody thinks that now they're an expert on Alaska because they've learned something about the 49th state. So it kind of puzzled me, actually, when we had FEMA workers coming to Alaska last summer believing that somehow or other we were going to be able to truck supplies from the Home Depot in Anchorage all the way up to Galena. Now, I don't doubt that their hearts were in the right place, but the fact of the matter is we lost valuable time. We lost a good season of disaster recovery because they simply didn't understand the geography of our state. Ambassadors, we are all ambassadors for our state, and we certainly feel that as we talk about the U.S. as an Arctic nation. Global interests in the Arctic is booming, absolutely. But my fear and my frustration is it seems like the United States is just now waking up to our region's potential. The administration is starting to pay attention. They're starting to say the right words. But words have to be backed with action. We've got an Arctic Implementation Fund, or excuse me, an Arctic Implementation Plan that was released several weeks ago by the administration. But a plan without the action, a plan without the funds, the resources behind it, it's not going to cut it. We're going to be taking the helm of the Arctic Council now in 15 months. And that means that this is more than event planning. This is more than just putting on a conference. It means carefully and intelligently advancing a vision into the future. And fortunately, where the White House may be falling short, I believe that the Alaska legislature is leading on this. You're working on an infrastructure plan for the Arctic. I know Liesl and Bob, you're taking point on that. So important that the state be stepping up because the state and the nation needs concrete steps going forward. So President's going to be releasing his budget. I believe it's the 4th of March. And we'll see. We'll see whether or not the administration is ready to put its money where its mouth is when it comes to Arctic priorities. Mediator. We all engage in the mediation role. I had my mediation or my mediator hat on full on last October when I helped to lead a group of senators to end the government shutdown. Ending brinksmanship responsible for a government shutdown is important to each of us. Alaska is home to about 16,000 federal employees. One of them is a gentleman by the name of Mike Greisbaum. He's from Anchorage. And Mike works full-time as a civilian technician for the Air National Guard. He ensures that the 176th Wing's search and rescue squadrons are mission-ready. Part-time, he is a lieutenant colonel flying the HC-130s. It's a pretty important job, pretty important work. But none of that mattered when the furloughs and the government shutdown kicked in. Since he was a full-time federal civilian, General Katkus had no choice. He had to lay him off. He had to lay off or furlough the search and rescue guys. They also furloughed National Guard technicians that are supporting the air refueling wing at Eielson. So the intended, or perhaps the unintended, consequences of brinksmanship didn't just revolve in our military. It didn't just focus on the air. It stretched from the air to the sea. Just ask those Bering Sea crabbers who couldn't get their allocation paperwork processed so that they could get their gear out on the water in time for the season to begin. This shutdown had a ripple effect hitting millions and millions until cooler heads prevailed to lift this nation out of uncertainty and put us on a stronger, more certain path. So I was pleased to be part of that important effort. So let's talk about some of the very positive developments that we've seen here in the States since the last time I visited here in February of last year. We all remember how in 2012, the Air Force announced it was pulling the F-16s out of Eielson. Tough time for all of us, not just the folks in the interior, but all around. After a 20-month fight, that talk came to an end last October. Working together, yes. This was really one of those unified efforts. Team Alaska persuaded the Air Force to abandon the wrong-headed proposal. We know that it would have undercut our security posture in the Pacific, and it would have been devastating for our economy in the interior. But it was truly, truly a team effort. In the Senate Defense Appropriations Committee, I had won an amendment that froze the move until the Air Force could consider fully our arguments. Up in the interior, Mayor Hopkins and the other interior mayors launched a tiger team when Representative Isaacson was mayor. He fully engaged in this. But they really worked to drive home the message to senior Air Force leadership. The Alaska legislature, led by all of our interior delegation, the Joint Armed Services Committee, it was truly an effort that gained note and notice, and it affected the outcome. You were all champions in that effort, so thank you very much for what you have done there. I'm watching the clock because I know you are too. There's just a few more quick things, and then we'll wrap it up. But it is important to recognize where we have made headway, because sometimes it feels like we're just always up against a brick wall. So it's okay to take a moment and reflect where we have done some good constructive things. We've been pushing with the administration, and not just this administration, but really in order to keep the promise made to Native Alaskans when it comes to fully funding Native health care efforts. And this is not just Native Alaskans, but our Natives nationwide. I was able to work within the Interior Appropriations Committee to get the feds to live by the law and fulfill their trust responsibilities financially. This is going to result in better health outcomes for Alaska Natives, but also hundreds of jobs around the state for our medical professionals. So this was an important initiative. We were also able to build a bipartisan coastal coalition for over 40 members of Congress. Now we're going to be seeing some of that disaster money, that fisheries disaster money, headed to Alaska to help our communities that were impacted by the 2012 Chinook runs. Charisse I know this will bring a smile to you. We have long worked on the issue of the legacy wells, or travesty wells, as we should appropriately call them. But Alaska is now going to have the funds for a more aggressive cleanup. We were able to set aside $50 million in a helium stewardship bill to help address this environmental crime. We couldn't get the administration to put it in, so as we found other opportunities, this has got to be a priority for us. It's got to be a priority for the government, and I am pleased that we're able to address that a little more readily. But we've got more challenges. We've got challenges, but they are opportunities as well. Bringing the new F-35 Joint Strike Fighter to Eielson. It's going to be a great effort for us. I'm feeling pretty optimistic about it. A new unmanned aerial vehicle mission for the interior also. The opportunity for expanding our missile defense radars and the Fort Greely operation to meet new threats. So a lot going on up in the interior. But I know everyone was just kind of dealt a whack when we got the news last week about Flint Hills. We're all very concerned that Flint Hills will no longer be refining crude as of June 1, and what this means, whether to the Pentagon's decision as they're considering the F-35s and bringing those to Eielson. I know that the community is still coming to terms with what this potential fallout will be. Hopefully, we can avert that fallout. But not only the concerns about investments in the interior, but the impact to the railroad, the impact to the Fairbanks Airport, the Anchorage Airport in terms of jet fuel supply, the jobs lost, the housing markets. We are all working on this together. I want to help where solutions can be offered on the federal side, but this is a key initiative for us as well. And then, of course, there is the ongoing challenge that continues to put human lives at risk. And this is the Interior Secretary's decision to deny the King Cove Road. This denial, in my view, was heartless. It was absolutely wrong. We passed legislation back in 2009. It was a historic omnibus bill, and it authorized the Interior Department to transfer land in the Eisenbach Road. It was a 300-to-1 transfer, a pretty good deal, more than a pretty good deal. But it would allow for a 10-mile gravel, one-lane, non-commercial use road. That's it. A 300-to-1 exchange. And all they wanted was 206 acres total. And of that, what would have been impacted was so small for a 10-mile connector road. And the day before Christmas Eve, the secretary called me on my cell phone. I was in Fred Meyer's parking lot going in to buy scotch tape and wrapping paper. And she called me to say that she was rejecting this road. And I can't tell you how furious, how angry, and how saddened I was. And that was just before Christmas. And to add further insult, no one from Interior has lifted a finger to help the people of King Cove since then. Now, the King Cove decision, it's more than a road. I think we all recognize it is more than a road. It is emblematic as to how the federal government believes that it has to somehow protect Alaska from Alaskans, that we can't be counted on to be good stewards of the land that we have fought for and we have worked for and we have raised our children up to honor and respect. But we somehow can't be trusted with that. There is far more at stake here than just a road. And I'm also reminded that every time the Coast Guard needs to brave the elements and go in and attempt a medevac in King Cove, it's not just the patient's life at risk. It is the lives of the helicopter crew. It happened just this weekend on Valentine's Day. Once again, an individual in distress needed to be evacuated, couldn't get the medevac to King Cove. They got as far as Cold Bay. And they had to call the Coast Guard in. And the winds were blowing 60 with gusts to 70 or 75. You couldn't see your hand in front of your face. And they put their lives at risk to airlift that 63-year-old woman out of King Cove. And the good news is, it's a good news story. She's in the hospital, she's breathing on her own, and that helicopter crew is hopefully back with their family. But there is a safe and an easy way to help these people. And the only thing that's standing in the way is our own federal government that says somehow we need to make sure that every bird is protected before the lives of Alaskans will be protected. That's wrong. That is absolutely wrong. I have been told. I've been told. Get over it, Lisa. I have been told to just get past this issue. Let's just get past this issue. Let me tell you, that is not going to happen. In addition to my role as mediator and ambassador and all that, I can also be a hellraiser. And I am going to be a hellraiser on this. I'm going to channel my inner Ted Stevens, and we're going to get this road. It's too important to us as Alaskans. Ernest Greening said it best when he noted, many things have been done for us, even more things have been done to us, but very little have we been permitted to do by us. That's the quintessential challenge for Alaska today, just as it was in territorial days. So what Mike Stepovich started in Alaska and what we collectively have built in the past half century, it's pretty darn special, I think we would all acknowledge. We draw attention from folks around the world. We realize the world gets to experience Alaska in small doses. I mentioned the reality TV shows. People take a week cruise. They may have a month in a motorhome. People are fascinated by the glimpses of Alaska that they see. But we are the lucky ones. We are the ones that get to call this wonderful place home. And we are the ones who are best positioned to make this state a sustained and a sustainable success story by unlocking all of our state's possibilities responsibly for our children and the generations to come, and raising the standard of living in every corner of this state that we love. That's my charge, and that's our challenge. And that's why I wake up every morning ready to fight for, to be an ambassador for, or perhaps to raise a little hell for Alaska. Good to be back home with you.
On behalf of the body, Senator Murkowski, thank you very much for taking the time out and addressing us. And you have agreed to take some enlightened questions from the body. So with that, Representative Charisse Millett has a question.
Senator Murkowski, it's always good to see you home, and it's always good to see you in D.C. fighting hard for Alaska. I really appreciate all the hard work you do. You're a great role model for all Alaskans. My question to you is, we came down to visit on another issue. The member from District 40 and I stopped in your office with a group of the Alaska Native Village CEOs, again fighting for the rights of Alaskans to be protected. We have 650 contaminated sites, a 1998 report with four recommendations that have never been done. We just in this body passed a resolution to encourage the federal government to do that. What can we do to engage the Department of Interior, the BLM, to look at those sites and either trade lands, fix the lands, or do any action at all. They have turned a blind eye. They did the report themselves. They are the ones that identified those 650 sites. And the other thing that bothers me greatly, Senator Murkowski, is that, not one environmental group has come to the aid of Alaska when it comes to cleaning up the sites. We were the test ground for everything for the federal government. Alaska was. And we have never, ever had one environmental group come to aid us, come to defend us, come to help us, come to advocate for us. All they do is try to shut down and protect the lands. They don't even recognize that we have poisoned lands here that they could be helping us clean, and we get nothing for them. Tell me how we can engage the environmentalists, how we can get the Department of Interior to help us, how we can get Secretary Jewell to understand our issues. Well, I mean, what is it going to take? Is it going to take all 720,000 residents of Alaska to fly down to Washington, D.C. and surround the Department of Interior building and let our voices be heard? Is that what it's going to take?
Well, you're starting right here, Representative Millett, and thank you for your leadership on this issue as well as what you were able to advance with the legacy wells. Fact of the matter is this isn't new. These contaminated sites just didn't happened this year, last year, 5 years ago. They have been part of our state's really very, very disappointing and sad history when it comes to the federal government coming in, utilizing lands, and leaving a mess behind, walking away from a responsibility. Now, if it was a private entity, you can bet that they would be on them like that. But because it's the federal government, all of a sudden there's a little more latitude and leniency because, well, it's going to cost something to clean it up. Well, it certainly will. It certainly will. But that's the obligation that you have. But unless there is the squeaky wheel out there, unless Alaskans are up in arms, unless the legislature comes out and says, this, we demand that the federal government be responsive. We demand that in your budget priorities, you acknowledge this responsibility. The fact that they have commissioned the report, have identified it. Now, what they're doing, as you know, is prioritizing those areas in terms of greatest need. You would have thought that they might have done that after that report was released, almost two decades ago now, 15 years or so. So we're pushing them on that. But it's going to take all of us, just as it did with legacy wells. We now have legacy wells on their radar. When I first came to the Senate, the issue of our conveyances of our lands was one that, yeah, they knew that they had that obligation. But since nobody was really pounding the drum, they took their time. We've been able to speed them up on that. We've been able to advance funding for legacy wells, although the administration still has not placed the priority within their budget. The fact that we're able to get dollars out of a termination of a completely unrelated program, the Helium Stewardship Bill, we cannot relax on this. So I need you, I need everyone in this chamber to make sure that as we are taking forward Alaska's priorities, we continue to remind the federal government what their obligation is. You know that I'm an ally on the other end back there. But the louder we can be on this, the more, quite honestly, we can embarrass our own federal government to be the stewards of the land that they are asking all of us to be. Maybe a little shame can go a long way.
Thank you, Senator Murkowski. Next question, Senator McGuire.
Thank you. Welcome home, Lisa. It's so good to see you. And I really appreciated your remarks today. I always do. But in particular, the remarks about Eisenbeck Road and what that means for Alaskans, I think you hit the nail on the head that it's way more than an issue of public safety. It's about the federal government recognizing that we can take care of ourselves and that we should be trusted with our own land. So thank you for that. My question is on the Arctic. Thank you for your leadership there. you used the quote from Ernest Greening, not much has been permitted to do by us, and I agree with that. My co-chairman and I, Bob Herron, have been trying to do that at the state level. And my question is, do you think that the bill that you've introduced with Senator Mary Landrieu to look at revenue sharing in the Chukchi and the Beaufort for the state of Alaska, 37.5%, I think it's 22 and then another 10, maybe describe that to us and how we can help advocate and support you. Could that be a vehicle and an argument for us? We already do so much here. You know this, having been a state representative for the Arctic with coastal erosion. We're already looking at Arctic infrastructure investments. But perhaps that's an argument for you that if we got that money here in the state of Alaska, we could do for ourselves. The federal government just seems unwilling. We've been advocating for two decades now for our own polar class icebreaker, as you know, and we're getting ready to take this chairmanship, and I think this might help. So any words on that?
Thank you, Senator McGuire. It is about us as a state acting on our own, taking the initiative, taking a leadership role. When we talk about the Arctic, though, I want to make sure that we don't kind of absolve the nation of its responsibility as an Arctic nation. Yes, we are the Arctic state, but because we are one of 50, we are an Arctic nation. And so when we talk about how we're going to build out our infrastructure, don't let anybody suggest to you that somehow or other this is an Alaska earmark. This is Alaskans to shoulder. When we're talking about navigational aids in the Bering Straits, quite honestly, the level of shipping and the commerce that's going back and forth there is such that it's benefiting the world. And as a nation, we want to make sure that there's a level of safety out there, that there's a safe port in a storm. We're going to need the infrastructure. We all know that. Alaska needs to step up and engage and be a partner, and that's why I'm pleased with some of the more innovative approaches that I think we're taking here that are out on the table. But let's not let the federal government off and say, well, that's Alaska's to deal with. They've got a role here. They need to lead. This country, this administration needs to lead on the issue of the Arctic. So can the FAIR Act, the revenue sharing bill, be helpful? Absolutely. Absolutely. If we can get that level of revenue sharing as the host state for that exploration off our shores, that can help us facilitate some of the capital that's going to be necessary for the issues that we face ahead. Now, I'm not going to suggest that this is going to be an easy measure to advance. The administration has said that they don't like our bill. And I think they don't like it because they know that if states understand that they will get a portion of that revenue sharing, they might be more encouraging of development of our resources. I happen to think that that's not a bad thing for us as a nation, that we should be more secure in our energy. I think that that's something that we should encourage. But we're not seeing that signal. Senator Landrieu has now stepped in as chair of the Energy Committee. So as the chair and the ranking member, I think we kind of intimidate a few of those folks that aren't so keen on resource development when it comes to the energy sector, but we'll see how that goes. But I do think it is an opportunity not only for Alaska, but for other states as well. And keep in mind that this is not just revenue sharing as it relates to offshore oil and gas. This is renewables. If we have wind offshore, the revenues will derive from that. And it's also as to onshore renewable resources. So if we are using our federal lands for for development of our energy resources, whether conventional or renewable. This is revenue that can come to the states. So we're trying to broaden the focus here, which I think is critically important to the success of its passage. I was told coming in here that you've actually got a hearing scheduled sometime this afternoon, 1 o'clock this afternoon. So might have to stop by and see how you're doing. But thank you for all that you're doing on the issue of the Arctic. Critically important.
It looks like we have about 10 minutes remaining. The order of questions will be Representative Newman and then Representative Gara. And if we have time, to Representative Negyak.
Thank you, Senator. Welcome. And, Senator, you talked about the many hats that you wear, so I'd like to ask you to put on your camouflage hat as a member of our Congressional Sportsman's Caucus, and quite frankly, one of our most informed members is an active hunter and fisherman. As you're aware, there was a meeting recently in the lower 48 of wildlife managers and wildlife managers, including our Commissioner of Wildlife, Commissioner Cora Campbell, on federal intervention into states, where there was an announcement made that there's action moving forward by this administration to encumber Pittman Roberts and Dingell Johnson funds over to the federal government for federal government management of wildlife and game on all states. And I know that you've got some legislation that you're currently working on. If you could help us understand that issue a little bit better and how not it would just impact our states, again, with federal intrusion into our rights, but our states' budgets. But this is a huge, huge issue that all states need to come together on. Could you tell us what you're doing to help out on that?
Well, thank you, Representative Newman. And insofar as kind of reallocating or appropriating these Pittman-Robertson funds, I don't think that they can do that without a change in the law. But that's not to suggest that there hasn't been some unilateral action out of the administration when they're seeking to advance something, whether it's selective implementation or waivers when it comes to Affordable Care Act or oftentimes on immigration enforcement. So, I don't believe that they can do that, but my concern is that there may be that effort to do so. You mentioned the bipartisan sportsman bill that was introduced about 10 days or so ago. I am the lead Republican on this. It's kind of a compilation of various sportsman, hunter, fisher initiatives. Probably the most, I won't say most important, but a very significant piece of it is that our federal lands are deemed to be open unless specifically closed when it comes to hunting, fishing, and recreational shooting. There are other provisions in it that relate to ammunition. Also, the polar bear that are shot legally and the inability to actually transport them back into the country. So there's a whole host of various sportsmen's initiatives that are included within this bill. I'm actually relatively optimistic that we will have a chance to have this legislation heard in this Congress at a time when maybe other measures will get stalled out the closer we get to November and elections. But this is one where we've got good, strong bipartisan support, and I think enough initiative to try to advance this. But your point about the overlay of federal regulators when it comes to our management of our lands, our wildlife, and our fisheries is something that I think we all recognize we are best to stay just one step ahead of what they're thinking back there in Washington, D.C. We've seen that here in our refuges, down on the Kenai, down on in the Aleutians area, up north. We feel these incursions all too closely. Thanks for your leadership on it, Mark.
Thank you. Representative Gara.
Thank you. Welcome, Senator. Since Representative Curtula is not here, she was our chief complimenter. Let me offer you a few thank yous before I ask you a question. We miss you on Government Hill as usual. So
likewise,
you are missed. Bipartisanship has become sort of a dirty word by some in Washington, D.C., and I appreciate the work that you've been able to do across party lines on a number of issues. So thank you, despite the criticism that you might unfairly get, and including on the Eisenbeck Road. I think you and Senator Begich have pounded both parties on the need for that road to save lives, so thank you. The question I have is, I know the federal government is facing budget constraints. We're facing budget constraints. I've heard words from the president on education and sort of helping us improve outcomes. In this state, with the current budget proposal, we might be facing approaching 800, 900 educator layoffs in a four-year period. Is there any hope that the federal government might be able to do anything to help states retain educators, to help states on education, either from the president, from the House, from the Senate, anything bipartisan in that way, so we can help protect our public education system?
Well, I appreciate the focus on education. I know that you have several different initiatives. I know that the governor has laid out some of his priorities in this area. What we're focused on right now, I serve on the HELP Committee, the Health, Education, Labor, Pensions, and the focus right now is twofold. One is the Higher Education Act, working to reduce the cost of higher education. I feel like I need to declare a conflict of interest, having just got one kid through and one in the middle. The other end of the education spectrum is where we're focusing right now on early learning and the opportunities that can be made available to our earliest learners in preschool there. There really hasn't been that much of a focus or a discussion, if you will, about so what can we do to ensure that the funding to the states, whether for Title I or the appropriate role that the federal government has, is at a sustainable level. When you're talking budget cuts, unfortunately, we're seeing that administered across all departments, rightly or wrongly. When I think about how we can best work as a state to make sure that we are retaining our teachers, I think of a few things. I think we've got some good mentorship programs that are critically important, particularly to our young and our new teachers as they're getting started. But we need to make sure, awful as this sounds, we need to make sure that our teachers are compensated fairly. And it's not awful. They put in an incredible effort for all of our children. So making sure that the support for compensation is there. I also happen to be one that was a beneficiary of student loan forgiveness. When I got out of school, goes to show you how old I am, but it was one of those things, in fact, probably one of the most important things that brought me back home, was knowing that the expenses that I had incurred, not only in undergraduate but in law school, could be reimbursed by the state. And I think that when we talk about brain drain, whether it's with our educators or whether it's, pick your field, that's something that as a state, if we can invest in our young people, that pays dividends for life. So I've long been a proponent of our state's loan forgiveness program. I know that that's hard to talk about right now with the budget issues that you face, but I do think that we need to be, again, looking at ourselves as a state and saying, how do we ensure that we keep our young people here, we keep those educators, that we make sure that the communities that we have are strong and thriving. Thanks, Les.
Thank you. Senator Murkowski, and great respect for our good friend from Barrow, Senator Benny Negyek, this will be the last question. Thank you. Benny.
Thank you. Thank you very much for what you've done for the state of Alaska. And I know, and this is coming from a person who, we're all impacted with the actions by the federal government. We all are in the state. But those of us who live in those areas who are, you know, who are intimately impacted, personally impacted, physically and mentally impacted by the federal government, in the oceans where we live, it's very important. But we need to, we thank you for having us be allowed to be part of the, at the table anyway. And I think what happened was to keep our people from being enriched by the resources that surround us. I know we have, it's offshore. But what's ironic is that they're closing it up for our in our waters, but 40, 50 miles away, the Russians are going to be drilling. There's nothing that's going to be stopping them because the historically they've been able to do that. So if those people who in who are listening in the environmental field, or who have heard us over in the past several years, you said, I'm going to be nice. If you're so worried about the environment, you're worried about our oceans, help us open ANWR. It's our land. Help us. If you're worried about the ocean, help us do it on land where we can watch it. And everybody here, no matter who, which party you belong to, please help us. Because it's gonna help us. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, I don't need to add to that. That was beautifully put. Thank you, Ben. Thank you all.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Murkowski. And I just remind us, that's why Benny Nagyak is our best friend. So, Senator Murkowski, on behalf of the body, thank you very much for coming and taking the time today and your presentation. Much appreciated, thought-provoking. But again, safe journeys, and God bless you.
Mr. Majority Leader, President, I move